I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Tonight, we want to explore how seeds can change the way we look at the dinner table, our dinner table, and how we can cultivate a sustainable approach to home-scale food security.
So before we start, I want to give you a little introduction to Leah and Nick. So we have Leah and Nick of Foundroot, our local Alaskan vegetable seed and homestead supply company. Leah and Nick started their journey on Salt Spring Island. That sounds really, like, romantic to say Salt Spring Island for some reason. I want to hear more about that. Salt Spring Island, BC, where she was running a permaculture market garden and Nick was doing a natural building apprenticeship. After traveling through the Pacific Northwest, Nick convinced Leah to leave the warmth of her hometown of Phoenix, Arizona, for an adventure in his home up north, and have since been adapting their farming, permaculture, and seed-saving knowledge to this new terrain. In addition to growing food, they also enjoy caring for their thousands of pet worms in their vermicompost bin, fishing, wandering the woods, and making plans to build their first home, a tiny house on wheels. Wow, welcome to the show, you guys. It's great to have you here. We got a lot of fun things to talk about. So where do you want to start?
Well, maybe just start with Foundroot. What does that name mean, and maybe what was the inspiration behind it?
Foundroot began with a long list of words. Nick and I just started trying to find a name for this concept that we were working with by listing words that described what we were trying to create. And ultimately, we just started matching words together, and we came up with Foundroot. And what that means to us is several different things. It's manyfold, part of which is we feel like we found the root of the problem in our food security and our food supply. It's also quite literal in that we've found the roots of these plants. And a huge part of what we do is discussing the history of seeds and that lost history. And so it's also about us as a community and as a culture finding our roots and reclaiming those.
That's beautiful. Yeah, so let's talk about what is seed saving about and what's the history of that.
Do you want to take that one?
No, I think I'd.
We can talk about it, but we're not going to talk too long.
Seed saving is the idea of growing out plants to collect the seeds from them in a large scale or a small scale. We focus on the small scale. So that means any home gardener, whether it be a small space just for the fun of the summer season, or if it's actually a homesteading space where people are trying to provide their food for the entire year, they're able to collect those seeds. And we only sell open pollinated seeds. So there are several different types of seeds on the market right now. You can buy hybrid seeds, which have been made in a lab. You can buy genetically modified seeds, which are sort of a hyperextension of that. Or you can buy old-fashioned seeds, which are often referred to as heirlooms. Heirlooms are simply open-pollinated seeds with a story behind them. So all heirlooms are open-pollinated, but not all open-pollinated seeds are heirlooms.
Okay,
and what does heirloom
that
mean?
Yeah.
What is heirloom? Let's just
Sure. That. It's just those seeds with a story. So they have some history behind them. Maybe a family bred them out, and there's some story. There's a location, a sense of place. Maybe it actually has to do with our American history. But there's heirlooms from all over the world. We sell some Japanese heirlooms, some French heirlooms. They're just really old seeds that have been developed over time. They're very steady varieties, very tried and true. You know what you're going to get, and they're collected. The seeds are collected in an old-fashioned way. So in my opinion, anyone can do it.
So when you're saying open-pollinated, you mean that the bees and the insects are doing the work, or, you know, the wind blows and they're rubbing against each other? It's not like you're trying to cultivate a particular aspect of the plant anymore. It's already that it's already expressing that, and you're just allowing it to progress on its own? Is that what that means?
That would be super, you know, non-controlled open pollinated. But you can still have open pollinated seeds with some human interactions.
So you still might be helping them actually.
You might be helping them, and that's how you do open pollinated mm-hmm. breeding. And so you can cross-pollinate by using, you know, a little Q-tip or a paintbrush and crossing those. But that's still considered open pollinated okay. as long as you're allowing those varieties to be true and be what they originally were and not breeding them out to a single trait and then combining them in a lab.
Got it.
Which is what hybrid seeds are there.
Okay. Yeah. And then go ahead and make the distinction for everyone. Yeah, so hybrids are they're breeding them out to get a specific trait, and then they're combining them with another seed with a particular trait, mm-hmm. and then they combine them and they make something different.
And they use yeah. a chemical alteration in the lab to do that?
They can do that physically, too, I believe. I think they can do it the same way, but the result is that it's not a stable seed variety. After another generation, it could just be anything,
okay.
depending on what they had.
If you grew out a heirloom seed and it was a stable variety, you know you're going to get whatever you collected. If you grow out a hybrid seed, for example, the man that I studied with, Bill McDormand, he owned a vegetable seed company called Seeds Trust at 6,000 feet in Montana, and him and his father were working very hard to develop stable cold climate seed varieties, and there was a pepper that they liked, and they grew out that pepper, and out of, it must have been thousands of plants, they got four that were actually that original pepper. It was dozens and dozens of different types of peppers that were in there.
Okay, and then make the distinction for genetically modified. Is that what that's going to be?
That's actually going into a lab and splicing in genes mm-hmm. from either a different plant or something outside of the plant kingdom even.
Which is a big issue right now, so yeah. we're definitely going to get – because you know something about the genetically modified foods, right, in the food supply, so we definitely want to at some point address that.
Yeah,
a little bit of something.
You know,
smiling.
And I also wanted to ask about, what's legal? I know there's a big issue around seed ownership.
Yeah.
And, can I, let's say, buy a packet of Johnny's organic seeds, and can I then just use the seeds that I grow from that strain? Is that legal to do that? Or am I supposed to buy, or are they being bred to not be usable beyond the first crop? I don't really know how
it
works.
Monsanto does that with their product that the farmers who are using, like their Roundup Ready corn. When the farmer has to actually buy seeds every year from Monsanto, and I know they, because of the cross-contamination that's been happening, certain seeds blow in other farmers' farms, and then those farmers, Monsanto's been prosecuting farmers because some of their seeds have shown up. They're seed-saving their own seeds, but Monsanto's stuff gets in there and contaminates
them.
So
big issue around here, and I just want to pull apart the distinctions so we understand what's what for the home gardener.
Yeah, because you guys are radical seed seeds. That's like a radical act these days.
I wish it wasn't, but yes, it is kind of a radical act, and there are a couple things you have to be aware of. One, are you selling them? If you're not selling them, it may or may not be legal. I'm not going to tell you to go save seeds from seeds that have patents, but no one's going to be checking that. And there's really very little way for them to prove it besides growing it out themselves. And even then, there's many carrots that look identical to each other. So it's a challenging thing. But in terms of us and in terms of sales, there are PVP patents, which are patents on open pollinated bred varieties. So you need to be aware of whether or not that variety is a newly bred variety and therefore may or may not have a patent on it. Those do age out, and after they age out, people swoop in, start breeding them, and then spread the love all over the place.
So age out means just that the limit of the patent expires.
You can only have it for so long.
This is like almost sounds like pharmaceutical industry where you have a patent on a drug for a certain amount of time, and then eventually it's after 10 years, then a generic version of it can be made. So and then people can do whatever they want with it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
is there some kind of a watering down in the genetic efficacy of if you're collecting seed from generation after generation after generation that you would want to go to a fresh strain, or how does that work?
You want to be really careful about what type it is. So something like a tomato, each tomato is actually one genetic strain. It's a really safe variety. There's not going to be any I don't want to call it genetic mutation. It's almost like a repression that happens. And so you will just end up with an inferior, possibly inedible vegetable. With something like a tomato, that's really unlikely. Something like corn, really likely. You need to have a certain pool of different I mean, just a you need to grow a certain amount of each vegetable and make that gene pool nice and large, or you need to be in a community of seed savers where if you start limiting your gene pool in a certain variety, you can just trade with a neighbor and get some of their gene pool in there and reestablish the vibrancy of that plant. Certain books, we use seed to seed. It's something that we sell and utilize endlessly. They tell you exactly how many plants you need to grow of each tomato, pepper, corn, squash in order to maintain enough genetic diversity. And so something like squash, you only need 5 plants. But something like corn, you probably need about 100.
Wow. So do you have a favorite heirloom plant or a favorite story that you like, or a couple of favorites that you really, when you think about those stories, they just make you happy?
Sasha's Altai.
Yeah.
Sorry, what were you gonna say?
Yeah, Sasha's Altai was our favorite tomato to sell and to grow last year. We tried growing all our tomatoes outside, so we didn't get to reap the full benefits of that one. But the man I mentioned earlier, Bill McDormand, he was part of a group of people in the 80s who went over to Siberia and collected seed varieties. And so he told this story about this man, Sasha, who claimed that he had the best tomato around. And he said, I'm going to go get some for you. And the trip went on. And at the end of the trip, Bill turned to the man who was leading the trip and asked whatever happened to Sasha. And it turned out that Sasha lived a several-day walk into the mountains. And so he had actually walked home, picked up the tomato seeds, and right before they left, he was able to give it to Bill. And so that's how Sasha's Altai tomato made it to the United States.
That's a great story.
And have you grown those tomatoes?
We grew them last year. We're going to try again in a hoop house. They did really well. They were pretty frost-tolerant, but we didn't quite get the red tomatoes that we had hoped for.
Yeah.
They were outside in our garden space without much protection on them, though, so they made it pretty remarkably far for a cold summer and a late start.
Yeah, it's pretty gutsy to try to grow tomatoes. We did it a couple of years ago, and we didn't get much. So, yeah, especially the past couple of summers have not been great for outdoor tomato growing, I would imagine. So let's talk about – so you were running a permaculture market garden. What is that exactly?
Permaculture is an ecological design system that Nick and I utilize for not just how we grow our food, but it's also a way to organize your life. It's often defined as permanent agriculture or permanent culture, and it deals with everything from how you design your home to how you establish locations of things to rainwater collection and, of course, the common kitchen garden. It has 3 major principles, which is just to care for the earth, care for the people, and to share the surplus. So it does a lot for a variety of different applications. People use it in urban environments. People use it in rural environments. But it does allow you, if you wanted to live completely within the home and then just share or sell the surplus of what you are growing or cultivating or building and have that be your income. So the permaculture market garden was simply that. It was just utilizing permaculture growing principles such as no-till, mimicking natural systems, flowing space, it tries to work with nature as opposed to against it. So permaculture gardens are often made fun of for being quite weedy or utilizing a lot of the weeds in those gardens.
Well, the weeds are good. There's a lot of nutrition in the weeds. If you guys have not met Stella Lynn, we've had her on the show before, and she'll just wax poetic about weeds for an hour. So I learned a lot about weeds from her, and they're fantastic. So
hey, to go back a little bit, why is tilling wrong?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I guess it's not necessarily 100% wrong, but if you over-till the soil, you're destroying the soil horizons, and you're mixing everything up in there, and it'll do really well for releasing some of the deep-down nutrients over a short period of time, but you can kind of mine your soil that way, especially if you're tilling it, like, every year, or you're not, like, you know, letting it rest for a while, and so on a small scale, it's especially easy not to till all the time. You can maybe, you know, aerate your soil by planting root crops, or you can, on the space Leah was working on, they were using chicken tractors where they had the chicken coop near the garden, and they had a couple different garden spaces. And so for a while, the chickens would go into one garden space and wander around scratching up the soil and eating bugs and, you know, taking leaving behind fertilizer.
that sounds like what Joel Salatin in Omnivore's Dilemma, Polyface Farms, that's what he does, is has the chicken tractor.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a more natural way to deal with the soil.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing that if you're growing a large-scale operation, it's maybe not super feasible, but on a small scale or even a medium-sized scale, you can definitely do most of your soil maintenance that, like, ways or in using methods like that.
Now, for garden beds, what I've done is just take the pitchfork very lightly and just kind of break the soil up a little bit. Is that okay, or is that not necessary? I was thinking you just have to soften it up a little bit to plant the seeds.
Yeah, I think that's totally good.
Yeah, you want to be able to work your soil still. You know, you need to be able to harvest your carrots. They can't all be in an L shape. It needs to be loosened to a decent degree. What we did last year is we sheet mulched, which is often referred to as lasagna composting as well. And that's a method of composting in place.
Is this Hugel culture?
Similar but different.
All right.
Yeah.
What's that called?
Hugel culture?
Yeah. Hugel culture. Yeah, I noticed a couple of people who did that last year.
Yeah, that's something I'd really like to experiment with. I'm not sure. We might do a little bit of it this year, but we're renting a space currently, so it's hard to make these really long-term investments.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hugel culture is about a 3-year turnaround, and the beds are meant to be started at 6 feet high, and they utilize rotting logs, so it's quite labor intensive, which is actually very common in permaculture. Most things are very labor intensive. And the idea is that you're putting all this effort and all this work into it, possibly a financial investment. And then because of the methods that you're using and the design principles, over time, you're really reaping the benefits from it. You're lowering the inputs, and a huge element of that is the input of labor.
And you're getting a nutrient dense soil in the end, but I mean that's you're putting years in, so it doesn't make sense to rent a place and do it for the next person. Right. Or maybe it's a gift to them, but
it might be a gift for the next people this year.
We've made a lot of gifts so far.
Yeah.
So you were doing this in Arizona, and now you're trying to move this to Alaska. So obviously, other than the fact that it's hard to grow tomatoes outside here, what other kinds of things are you running into that you just don't have to deal? You know, we got lack of light, we have lack of warmth. So those are two big things. Like, what other major things are you having to deal with here?
There's a lot of random surprising things, such as squash, my favorite vegetable. I assumed winter squash would be easy to grow in a place that has a lot of winter, and that's not true at all. It's one of the more challenging things to grow up here, mainly due to a long season more than anything. We've found a lot of varieties that are very cold tolerant. They'll thrive. They wouldn't even die off with frost, but the fruits just don't get up to size. And so we're still comparing different varieties and trying to find the ones that'll really work for up here, but that was a surprising one for me. Spinach is definitely a cold-friendly green, but it bolts with the solstice, and so it goes to seed immediately, and it's really difficult to get spinach. Those were a couple of the surprising ones.
We're happy that you said squash is difficult because
we
haven't had a good time with the squash, so that we feel better since you guys know what you're doing and we don't. It wasn't maybe just us, right?
I always remember on the East Coast, squash being just as easiest, most wonderful thing, just bounty of squash.
And pumpkin patches, too. I grew up on Long Island, so, you know, these gigantic. Well, I mean, you don't get them as big as you get them here because you don't have the long growing season, but, I mean, just acres and acres of pumpkins, you know, no problem. Mm. So, it's a different reality here.
Yeah, definitely a change. We've enjoyed the fact that apples are possible here, though, which is definitely something new and something that's being developed around the valley. I don't know. I think the most important thing is that no matter where you go, to kind of adapt your expectations to the environment. And so taking joy in things like rhubarb and not lamenting the lack of rosemary is really important.
Have you tried rhubarb juice? Juicing rhubarb?
I have not done rhubarb juice, but rhubarb most things. Rhubarb makes its way into a lot of things for
rhubarb
us.
Rhubarb juice is really good. I've juiced it with lemon and apple. So apple, rhubarb, lemon is really good. Yeah, surprisingly good, actually. It's kind of a different twist on lemonade. It's excellent. So highly recommend that. And rhubarb is really renowned in Chinese medicine for its ability to get bowels to go.
So for people
who have issues with that, rhubarb's wonderful. So, you know, there's always some bright side on all that rhubarb.
We have a question that just came in from a listener. Joni Kirk writes, we live up Matanuska Glacier where we have essentially no soil. What might be the method to use for garden bed prep? And could you start spinach after solstice?
Yes, you could start spinach after solstice. You could also, I think what we did on our land with lasagna composting or sheet mulching would work really well to build up soil, which was basically we planted on soil we built on top of our yard, basically. We didn't actually till in or anything. And so you could start working on that. The basic process would be to, you could also start composting a lot and gathering, you know, leaves and anything you can find and start a serious compost to start using for soil. But do you have more to say?
No, I think it'd be really helpful to explain what sheet mulching is, though.
Oh, yeah, that would probably be helpful. So in our yard, we initially were going to tear out all the sod and then start tilling and then putting in beds. And we read a little bit more and thought back on other things we'd seen and decided to sheet mulch instead. So we laid down cardboard across the section of yard we were going to plant in and then put a layer of horse manure down and then gathered leaves and just yard waste, basically, and piled up a couple feet of it. And on top of that, laid down some compost that we could plant into. It should sit for a few weeks before you do that and decompose a little bit, but we ended up planting pretty much directly into it and actually cutting holes down in the bottom of the cardboard. And when we transplanted in, all the transplants went into areas where there's a perforation in the cardboard layer. And all over the season, it really broke down. We had mushrooms and worms growing out of it, and it's really developed a pretty rich soil really quickly. And
so you mentioned horse manure, though. I know a lot of people, because some people are putting their horses on a lot of anti-parasitic kinds of things. So are you just really conscientious of where you get your horse manure from?
Yeah, we actually have some friends that feed their horses really high-quality food and are not on a lot of antibiotics or anything. So, we were pretty conscientious about that choice.
Okay.
They're also avid gardeners, so they were aware of what we were using.
Yeah, because it seems like you can, I mean, these days with so many animals are put on so many antibiotics and antifungals, anti-parasite stuff, that you can kill all the good stuff in your soil if you're not careful.
So yeah.
It's sort of a bummer.
It's really important to know where you're getting it from and for the people you get it from to know what you're going to be using it for. Right.
But you guys aren't worried about chickweeds. So that's not a problem.
Actually, wasn't any chickweed in there.
Really? Okay.
A little bit. Yeah, probably. I think the joy of sheet mulching is that the first year you deal with very little weeds, but we have been told, which we'll experience next year, that will probably change very quickly. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how it looks this coming season.
Joni just added in. She says, we have a 3-bin compost, chicken droppings, some leaf, some straw, and also a greenhouse, but it'll be really nice to have some beds on the ground. She really appreciates your comments.
Oh, great.
Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. And if anyone else has got questions for Nick and Leah, please just go to our Facebook page, Bridge Everywhere, and we'll answer your question on the air.
So if we went over to your house right now, because I know, like, this is sort of like the pre-planning stage for everything. What kinds of stuff are we going to see that are in progress that you're doing? Like, what kinds of projects are you working on now? Because obviously you can't get outside and do anything. So what are you doing right now?
Packing seed envelopes. We're in the middle of garden planning stage. Last year, I actually just wrote a blog about it today on the FoundRoot website.
What's the website?
Oh, it's just www.foundroot.com.
Okay, great.
And we had what we currently refer to as the Great Tomato Massacre of 2012. I was really overzealous and really excited to start a new garden. Nick and I have grown in other people's spaces, but never started our own garden from scratch before. And especially farming, gardening is a completely different ballgame. And so it was exciting to get to apply a lot of these principles on our own terms last year. And so I just started growing plants in February. And we live in a 900-square-foot house, and we have really no basement or attic entry or greenhouse or any outside space to speak of where plants would be appropriate. So they were in our living room, and they just kept multiplying, and the pots kept getting bigger, and soon our couches were 2 feet apart from each other, facing each other, and every other square foot of the house was filled with hundreds and hundreds of plants. And we had a chilly spring, and so there was nowhere to put them. And so we built a small hoop house, but it still wasn't quite warm enough for things like tomatoes, and so we had a lot of plants in our home for a long time. And so I think the first thing is that we're probably not going to be selling much in the way of plant starts this year, because we don't have the infrastructure for it. And besides that, I think I started things earlier than they needed to be. I really don't think it's necessary to start tomatoes at the beginning of February if you're not doing them for sale. I really don't, especially if you're doing these small dwarf varieties like we are. So I'm probably going to be starting things March 1st and just being really mindful about the planning. So right now we're mapping it out. And actually the friends we spoke of who gave us the horse manure last year, we're going to be garden sitting for them while they're off with their horses on a pack trip. So we're actually going to be growing in 5 times the space,
yeah,
probably even more than that. So we have a lot of space to fill this year.
So any other projects related to getting this? So you've got garden planning, you're packing seeds, you've got some starts that you're going to wait to start those. Anything else? I was going to ask about the worm bin.
Yeah.
Because, how are you keeping, if you don't have the outside space, or where are they, or what are you doing?
They're in our kitchen. That's where we keep them. Those are still going right now. We've had a little bit of trouble with fruit flies recently, so we're working on solving that problem.
Yeah. Do you guys know Ellie Van Device?
Mm-hmm. That's where we got our worms.
Oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, she suggested putting everything in the freezer first to kill the fruit flies.
Yeah, I think it was Leah's grandmother lives in Florida, and we had kind of a wealth of citrus.
Okay.
And I think some citrus made it in without
without being frozen beforehand. So
you got fruit flies.
It's a new problem.
Yeah.
I think we're probably just going to allow the current bin to run its course and start a new bin. Just pull some of the worms and start a new bin.
Are there any like natural predators to fruit flies that you can get? Is it like ladybugs and aphids or anything like that kind of relationship? Or are you pretty much?
I haven't seen anything on that. Okay. No.
Besides sake, we left some out the other night and they all went in it. So I've been leaving bowls of sake around the house.
Wow.
And that
expensive
has been
little
taking care of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good one to know. So, why'd you go with sake instead of beer?
We had left a glass out. We left a glass out, and we found that there were 20 of them in there in the morning, and so we had some, and so I left some bowls out to try and
get them. Awesome! That's how great discoveries are.
Yeah, I think it's just a very sweet wine.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Oh yeah, good idea.
Great. So in the one of your statements, you were just talking about, we're down to the last minute here, but
before
maybe when we come
back,
I wanted to kind of tie this statement you made about how seeds can change the way that we look at our dinner table, and I really want to connect that, and maybe when we come back, we can say a little more.
So we'll be right back with Nick and Leah of Found Roots, our local vegetable seed and homestead supply company.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, KVRF 89.5 on your FM dial, Big Cabbage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Bridge to Everywhere. Before we start back with our show, I want to just really encourage you to become a member of Radio Free Palmer. Go to radiofreepalmer.org website, and there's various membership levels. Be a sponsor, join, support us in this amazing community endeavor. It's happening because of listeners like you, and we just really appreciate the support. And you're listening to a great conversation we're having with Leah Wagner and Nick Schlossstein, owners of Found Root, a local Alaskan vegetable seed and homestead supply company. So one of the statements that Leah had made is that they really want to help change the way people see that seeds can change the way we look at our dinner table. And what I'm hearing so far is when we get really connected to the source of our food and really get from the seed, that we maybe learn a little bit more and we get a little bit more connected to the ecosystem in which we're a part. So maybe you could say a little bit more.
Yeah, I think specifically in Alaska, a lot of people are afraid of seeds. They think the season's too short to grow anything from seed. And so just starting there, people who are home gardeners feeling empowered to grow from seed and understanding that many of our vegetables actually should be grown from seed. They don't like to be transplanted. You should always grow your carrots directly in the ground and certain things like that.
Why is that about carrots?
Oh, they don't like to be transplanted. Anything mm-hmm. that you eat the root of doesn't like to be moved.
Okay.
So
beets and carrots in particular?
Yeah, anything that you eat the root of, really. Also, peas don't need to be transplanted. We sell green scallions. Those don't need to be transplanted. All those sorts of things can be grown directly in there. We label all our seeds, whether or not it should be started indoors and transplanted, specifically for cold climate, or if it should be directly seeded outside. And last year, we only sold things that should be directly seeded. So most of what we sell can go directly in your garden. And even something like a squash, they don't really like to be moved very much either. And so it takes about a week for them to germinate, to get up to size, and there's really no reason to transplant that.
Is it warm enough just in a regular Alaskan, you know, summer? If we start planting like May 1st or between May 1st and May 15th, is it warm enough?
It depends on the year, it depends on the timing, and it depends on the vegetable. But for a lot of the things that grow well up here, they grow well because they like cold climates and they like cold soil. And so if you have it in cool soil in a sunny spot and it's meant to be directly seeded, it should do great. So that's part of it, thinking about the fact that seeds are part of this full system and that you don't need to be transplanting all your vegetables. But also for people who haven't grown things before, it's really surprisingly easy. And there's no reason why you need to buy everything at the farmer's market. Everyone can have a small herb garden just on their windowsill.
Yeah,
it seems like we have a really big disconnect from our food, and that's when we get into the controversial subject of what's going on with our food supply. In a moment, we'll talk about that, but I really sense that. I mean, I've talked to people who literally, I have people say, well, my sister's afraid to buy anything that's not in, like, a shrink wrap package. You know, it's like the idea that's like,
sanitizing
where do you think it came from? You know, but like to go out into a garden and to like dig and pick up a beet and shake the dirt off, you know, like that's just like it. We're kind of germ phobic, you know, or alcohol, hand sanitizer reality that we live in. But I mean, that's where it came from. And I think about, I mean, if you think about the scarier thing is actually the shrink wrap package. If you go out in your garden and you go and you dig up a beet, you know, I mean, there's dirt, but it's like probiotic dirt, you know, but versus like how many hands had to like get that thing and wash that thing and chop up that thing and then put the shrink wrap over it. Like that's frightening to me. Actually, when you think about our food distribution, like how it got from the ground, wherever it was, however far away it was, and then it got into that packaging at the supermarket. I mean, that's really where the danger is. That's where the contamination comes in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I guess I speak from a perspective of living in Palmer and also my friends and family outside of Alaska are pretty food conscious people too. So I am speaking to a specific group of people who either garden or shop at the farmers markets, and there's obviously a whole rest of the population that aren't doing either of those things. And I think we're quite lucky in Alaska that we have a culture of people growing food and valuing that and storing for the year because our produce gets quite sad in the winter.
Yeah. There is an amazing group of people up here. We've talked to a few people who do some similar things to what you do, and it's just really surprising. I mean, I grew up on Long Island, so my version of a garden was quite a different thing than what I'm hearing. I mean, it's like pioneering kinds of things that are going on up here. Mm-hmm. Did both of you guys have parents that were interested in this stuff, or are you guys sort of the radicals in the family?
We always had a garden at my parents' house mm-hmm. in Anchorage.
Well, you grew up in Anchorage.
Right? Yeah. We always had a garden. It was never like a big part of our food for the year, mm-hmm. but we'd go through different spurts of trying to get quite a bunch out of it, or you know, it being a little neglected. But we definitely always had the raspberry patch was a big thing. We always had to go, like, that was when I was a kid. I had to go spend 2 hours outside every evening once they started coming in, picking raspberries because there were so many of them. And so that was kind of my experience growing up with the garden, was not a lot of hands-on with mm-hmm. that. But
what about you, Leah?
Zero. Nothing at all.
So how'd you get interested?
I'm originally from the East Coast, and my family's on Long Island, northern New Jersey, and it actually got worse when we moved to Arizona, when my immediate family moved to Arizona, because it's a cement jungle, and it's very dry, and it's very challenging, and people value their lawns, and for the rest of my childhood, I grew up in tract housing where every house was identical to one another and there was cement walls in between and every single house had a pool and everything was sprayed with chemicals and maybe that was enough to do it. I'm not sure. But I went to a really interesting college and food was very much valued there and I grew up maybe not with a gardening background, but definitely with a very rich culture of Jewish people loving to eat. And so we, yeah. So we definitely enjoyed hole-in-the-wall places, good food. When I lived on the East Coast, we went apple picking every year. We definitely engaged with that. And that was far before there was any sort of organic food revolution. Farmers markets were really common the way they are now. It was different then, but going to school, I went to Oberlin College in rural Ohio, yeah. And Ohio isn't really the epicenter of the example of great agriculture, in my personal opinion, but at my school, there were a lot of people very involved in gardening and food, and I was involved in a cooperative system, so I lived and ate with other students, and we always prioritized local and organic, and I think that's where it began for me, and so immediately after college, the first thing I did was a farm apprenticeship in Maine.
Wow. What part of Maine was that?
Alfred. It's a small town about 40 minutes south of Portland.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, back to seeds, there's something that maybe gets missed, and that is the miracle of the seed, which if you plant a seed and you're connected to something quite miraculous when you do that. You take this little itty-bitty thing and you stick it in soil. You know, maybe you just prep it a little bit so that it's going to be successful. But do you ever stop just the wonder and the awe of the life process itself, just the miracle of the seed? How does that work?
Yeah, it's definitely amazing. I agree. I'm sure she has more thoughts.
That's really where the seed business came from more than anything. I mean, above and beyond the fact that I love to cook and eat and grow food and talk about food, I really love seeds. I like looking at them. I like comparing the way they look to one another. I like learning about the plant families due to how the seeds look. I think it is extraordinary that these tiny flecks of dust turn into these massive plants. I think it's absolutely extraordinary. And I love learning about all the different parts of the plant that you can eat and the seeds that you can eat. And I actually just love seeds as much as I love everything else.
Do you work with kids at all? Do you do any teaching in the schools?
I was a substitute teacher full-time all last year as we were getting Found Root going and have been a summer camp counselor and did. I'm also a yoga instructor and taught kids yoga as well.
Great. One of the things that I want to go back to something you said earlier about growing up with the tract housing and everybody's got a lawn and everybody's got a pool. It seems to me now such a crazy use of water when we've got a water shortage everywhere. And I know there was some group I think I saw it on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now. It was really getting people to think about what if you used your lawn to grow vegetables? You know, and I think about some of the places that I grew up, and actually when we went to acupuncture school back on the East Coast, and it was very much your lawn had to be a certain length and had to look a certain way, and it was you weren't even allowed to grow vegetables on it.
If you actually lay down in the grass and your skin touched it, it would break out. You'd start because of the chemical.
Yeah.
So, but think about all the gardening space. I mean, even in zero lot line houses, like if we thought that way, you know, we would actually put the Monsantos and the Archer Daniel Midland, you know, all those big companies would go out of business if we were just using even that small of a space. So it's fascinating to me how we think about what we do with space, and like it makes more sense to have a lawn and a pool than it does to have a vegetable garden. Yeah.
We actually. When we lived in Eugene for a brief moment, and for Thanksgiving, we had a couch surfer from couchsurfing.com pass through.
Oh, I have to go there.
And he lived up in, do you not know?
I've never heard of, no, I mean, I know about some of the other, like, Airbnb, but couchsurfing.com sounds really
Couchsurfing is free.
You really just put your name on there, awesome. And people will contact you, asking if they can come by.
And sleep on your couch.
Or in your yard.
Or wherever.
That's great. Okay.
We had a couch surfer come by, and he's from BC. He'd actually started a business that summer where he'd basically taken over people's yards as farm space. People who weren't necessarily going to work in the yard weren't going to be doing a whole lot, and he created a little CSA for them and sold the rest at market, and that was his... what he was going to do in the summers, and it had been pretty successful the first year. And so there's lots of things going on like that of people using the space, even if the people that own the space aren't necessarily going to turn it into
brilliant.
A small-scale farm.
But how many – one person can only – you know, I mean, even, like, you could probably do, like, 4 or 5 lot line spaces, and then you kind of tap out, so you'd have to hire more people if you're – but that's a great idea.
Yeah, it seems like a great idea.
Again, I think about growing up on Long Island, all the lawn care companies that would go around, you know, that were all these – you know, mostly seemed like Mexican workers coming out with their lawn equipment and spraying the lawns and mowing the lawns for people. Like, imagine now somebody coming and doing the CSA reality and actually planting a vegetable garden and, mm-hmm. you know, feeding the family and actually helping make people healthier.
Yeah.
Wow, what a cool idea.
And I think it's sort of a strange catch-22, but the sicker people get and the more problems that they're having with their food, the more likely they are to be open to something like that. And so even just shopping at the farmer's market is a huge step for a lot of people, or even considering organic. But I think someone coming into your home and offering to give you a garden is a pretty easy convince for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to see how he figured out how to charge for that and all that.
Yeah.
But since we're moving into that topic about food security, so what can you guys say about what you know currently about the food supply? What are your major issues with it?
Well, in Alaska, there's some major problems with it.
Please share.
They're all pretty self-evident, I think, as far as the fact that we don't really have that much actual food grown in Alaska. We were at a talk at the Botanical Gardens, and I forget the group's name, but one of the farmers from up in Delta Junction growing barley was giving a talk on food security, and he was really adamant about the having a grain that we can store and really fixing up the rest of our food security in Alaska, because we are pretty we could be pretty hard.
Can you spell
like 4 days away from, I mean, if there's something happens with the food distribution up here, it's like 4 days worth of food. So it's not even a week.
Yeah.
And then we would be even worse off in Palmer and Wasilla.
Yeah. And there definitely is a lot of room up here with the amount of food that you can get from fish and game and gardening. You can actually stock away a lot. If it's only potatoes, you can.
Well, there's a guy in Bethel, apparently. I forget his name, but I know
Tim
Myers. He's the guy with the Connex trailers that he's like sunk in the ground, and he's doing root cellars. That there's a he's,
Maybe.
He's do, I can't I don't know if that's
that probably is Tim Myers.
Yeah, probably.
He has a farm, and I'm sure
he runs the only CSA there. So.
Okay, that's probably him. Which is a really cool idea. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's really...
Yeah, I mean, I think we both have such extreme thoughts on it. It's just so obvious to us.
Pretend we don't know.
So definitely. Yeah. It's just it's something that's hard to describe. I think people in Alaska are actually a little bit more aware of it than other people because they understand that we are isolated. But for everyone who lives in a city who is really connected, who can pretty much get anything at any time... my family in the middle of New York City, you know, being able to go if they want, you know, Polish food at 2 a.m, they can go and do that.
Right.
And then when something happens like Hurricane Sandy, it's sort of a reminder of the fact that our systems are very fragile. And I think both Nick and I agree that it's not just food, it's all of our systems. And it's part of why we also emphasize permaculture and we also emphasize these composting methods, is because we're working not only to try and figure out ways to provide all of our own food, but also, or at least the bulk of it, with the rest being in trade, but also be able to create all the inputs as well. And so we didn't use fertilizers last year. We were just using compost teas. We were doing that sheet mulching. We're trying to source everything locally, and more so than that, we're trying to do it all ourselves, or at least develop systems where we could in the future.
And is that what you mean by home scale? Is that which it was home scale food security? So
yeah.
So really within the actual homestead, within your own homestead, there's actually a sustainable, regenerative process that's generating enough food to support you and your family.
Yeah, we're trying to create closed systems, and so we're trying to develop a way to create a sustainable garden and home space that will provide nearly everything that we would need in our own space. And obviously that's going to be a lifetime process. Found Root is definitely going to be something that evolves and takes shape over many years. We hope to have a naturally built home someday. Our first step is going to be this tiny house. And so for us, it's definitely a lifelong process of figuring out, especially in a challenging place like Alaska, how to live simply and live on our own. So like our friends up in Chicoloon, Ali and Jed, when the power goes out, they don't know. And I think that's a great, feeling to have.
Yeah, we love those guys. Ali's been on the show. She brought last fall, she brought a carrot that was, in the spring, she brought a carrot that she'd kept in her root cellar, or she brought us each a carrot, and, we chomped into the carrots on the air, and they were just as fresh and crunchy as, they'd just come out of the ground, so it's just fantastic.
They're amazing growers. Yeah.
But yeah. Speaking of that, the community, so you're talking about creating closed systems on the one hand, so that, you're as your own homestead, you can actually create all the things that you need, but part of the other problem with our food supply is this lack of connections, so there is an aspect, like you're trading seeds with your neighbors, you're trading information with your neighbors. Somebody's got goat
and trading chicken. Surplus
uh-huh.
with
and
neighbors,
somebody's
yeah.
got extra goat yeah. milk, somebody's got extra eggs, somebody has extra tomatoes, all that. So it's like a self-sustaining, so individually you're self-sustaining, but really that's supported by the community.
Exactly.
And that's something we also gotten away from.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the more people start working on whatever is their own project. Maybe somebody gets really interested and has tons of mushrooms, or maybe somebody's working on has goats and is getting a good supply of goat's milk. Those are all the sorts of things that create a good community and actually a lot more security in the long run, the more people working on a diversified group of things rather than relying on one guy growing carrots and potatoes.
Right. Yeah.
And we're all about doing work parties and tool shares, and we're developing a really nice community here in Palmer of people who also have that mindset. And so we've been able to learn a lot from our friends, such as tanning hides and wild mushroom and different types of wild medicinals and things that we didn't know about. And we are always willing to trade seeds for other things. And so if people are lacking finances, we are not particularly apt hunters yet, and we do eat meat, so we're always willing to trade for different things. We haven't had bees yet, and so we've traded for honey, things like that.
Great.
You're listening to Nick and Leah talking about sustainable gardening, and if you have questions, go ahead and put it in Facebook on Bridge to Everywhere, because we'll ask your question on the air. And we had a suggestion coming in just on the issue of fruit flies. If you add in a little bit of wood ash into the into the bin, that seems to cut back with the worms.
That's a great suggestion.
Between the wood ash and the sake, maybe you won't have to
maybe we don't have to give away our
worms.
Sake anymore.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the small house. So you guys were talking about doing one of those, it's like 250 square feet, kind of, is that what
I think it's more like 100.
100 square. So it's really small, and it's something that you can put on wheels and you can tow wherever you want.
It's actually built on a flatbed trailer.
Built on a trailer, okay.
Yeah. And we haven't started construction yet because it's been kind of wintery for a while now.
Okay, so it's kind of like four toll booths put together is what you're talking about living in. That's a pretty – and you guys would live in that space? And have land that you've purchased? Like, that would be your starter house?
That's the theory. That? Yeah, we're working on it, working on the details. I think one of the things that we want to – as we're coming up with these designs is we'll try to maximize as much usable outdoor space around it as possible. So we're trying to figure out a way to build a modular deck that we can bring with us and put on the outside, and also a bit of a roof extension we can drop down when it's moved and then pull it back up. But
so how does this go with the vision that you're talking about finding a permanent space to do this permaculture in? So, or is this just like the the house that can travel with you. Like that'll be on your space where you're going to be, and then you can travel around a little bit with the house if you want to. Like, because it seems like two. It's like one seems like incredibly mobile and light, and the other one seems like we're in it for 10 years. So those are two. To me, they're sort of two different things.
Well, it also, when we do get land, it'll be a place that's immediately built and can be dropped there.
Great.
And then the work can go towards working on a garden space, doing anything else we need to like really modify the land for the long run, which might be like putting in a pond or clearing out some trees and things like that. So it'll really free up our efforts towards working on the land when we do get some land. And then it's also, yeah, it gives us the ability to maybe locate it somewhere for fall or something like that if we're going to go on a hunt or, you know, want to go somewhere else for a while.
Pick up your house and take it with you.
But, yeah, the idea is definitely to have a home base for it.
Mm-hmm. We're not trying to create a mobile home. It would only be moved maybe to two or three different locations throughout the year. And we are trying to, because the growing season is so intense for us, we are trying to live a bit more seasonally. And that's the hope, is that we'll be able to save some money to start figuring out where we'd like to buy some land in Alaska and what that looks like for us. And so still being young, we're trying to be able to establish those financials and figure out that space, but still be able to maintain a home, because at some point you get pretty tired of giving away all your things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you did a natural building apprenticeship. What is that exactly?
I was on Salt Spring Island. I'd been living in Juneau for a long time, and I'd wanted to learn a skill for quite a while, and so I started looking into natural building. I got really interested in the idea, and that has a lot of different facets to it. It could be straw bale building, which I think a lot of people are familiar with, or cob, which is more of a warm weather sort of place where you're actually just packing kind of a specific mix of mud and straw up and building out of that, which is actually a traditional, I think, like Welsh or Scottish style of building. But researching all those, I came across a guy who does straw clay. His name's Robert Laporte. If you look up his company, which is EcoNest Building Company, there's a lot of good examples, and he builds really high quality, very, very nice homes. But the basic technique with that is he does timber frame structures and then uses a lattice system to kind of create the walls, and then the walls are actually built out of straw coated in a clay slip. So it's actually mostly straw with just a coating of clay, and you use that, it's loose straw, and you pack it down inside forms and build up the wall that way. And so it's actually pretty quick to build. You can put up walls fairly fast. It's pretty labor intensive for the, you know, week or two you're doing that. But it has a couple of advantages. It's got a lot of mass to it. The clay is coating all the straw, so it keeps it from rotting, and it actually has a pretty good insulation value. There's a guy actually down named Lassa, I forget his last name, but he's down in Homer, and he came to a workshop we were facilitating, and he does his own version of it, which actually incorporates a lot more wood chips than straw, and he uses, yeah, pretty much the same method. So it's something that's been tested up here, and it seems to be working really well for him, and he's trying to popularize it, but that's something I got really interested in, would hope to build a house out of.
So that's your eventual plan for the house, not just the small house, but that's the direction you want to move.
But, and the part of the small house is to give us time to actually plan that and do that right, instead of trying to throw it up as quickly as possible.
Does a house like that pass a code, building codes?
Well, the real good part of that is, and I haven't looked into like the Palmer area codes, but largely it's been accepted by codes because the structure is held up by both timber frame and 2x4s, and then the walls themselves are there's no load bearing on the clay slip and straw. And one of the big advantages of it is after you have it plastered and you put a breathable like earthen or lime plaster on it, it's still breathable, so it'll channel moisture through it, and so you get rid of a lot of the problems of moisture buildup in your walls.
So you're not worrying about mold?
No. I mean, the clay's going to suck the water right out of anything trying to grow on it.
Okay.
That's great.
Yeah.
Can you do a two-story house that way, or is that just a one-story?
Yeah, you could build a two-story house out of it. Usually he doesn't, though, and I haven't seen too many examples of really tall houses like that. But you could definitely build up at least two stories on it.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked into Earthships at all? Have you seen
I got to. When I was researching Alice, I got totally into looking into book after book of those sorts of things.
Those sort of fascinate me, and I don't know. I mean, it might be. I don't know how you could do it up here.
I mean, they seem to be in the desert in the southwest.
Because of the sunlight, because they're running it off of solar.
I think like that design's a good design for anywhere. Like up here, it would be a great design having just a big south-facing wall and bermed on the north side. Like that's probably the perfect design for up here. But maybe a few less windows and maybe not as many tires.
Hey, I wanted to ask, I know that you guys recently did a sweet seed swap over at Midnight Sun Yoga. How did that go? Do you plan on doing another seed swap and maybe any other events you have coming up?
Yeah, we did one down in Homer and then we did one here in Palmer, and both were really successful. People traded a ton. They also purchased a lot from us, and we did a lot of nice sharing of information about permaculture, seed saving, and vermicompost was one of the major topics. And there's a chance that we'll be doing one in Soldotna the beginning of May, the first weekend in May. That would probably be the last for the year. And for us, it's really intended to be an annual event. So the hope is that people will trade seeds, exchange with neighbors, ideally save their seeds, and then be trading those instead and kind of set a precedent for that. So before people start perusing their catalogs, are able to figure out what they can get from their community first and what they don't have to pay for, and then from there they can supplement.
Do you have any of this on a website where you can track what people have? So when they're coming to the seed swap, they kind of have an idea, this person's got this person's got that. Is that something that's in infrastructure yet, or is that something that you're working
on? Not yet. That's a great idea, though. Yeah. We should definitely
Seems to me that would be really, if there's a way to set up something where people were submitting what they actually have, and then they kind of know like what they're looking for, so they know, I want to go to this seed swap because there's going to be these people who have that, and I want to trade. So you could actually be starting the trading process before you actually get there almost.
That's a great idea. One epic version of that is through the Seed Savers Exchange, and they do an annual yearbook. If you're a member of the Seed Savers Exchange, you get a nice, big, beautiful book, and it's people from not only all over the country but all over the world. And so especially for a place like Alaska, I found a Ukrainian man who seems to have a lot of really ideal seeds for our climate. So if people are interested in doing that in a larger way, that's a great opportunity.
Now, if I want to save some seeds, can you just quickly walk me through the steps? I mean, let's say I grow a really good tomato and I just cut the tomato open. Do I dry the seed out? Do I wash it off? Do I store it in a brown paper bag?
For a tomato in particular, tomatoes are actually one of the ones that we recommend for a beginning seed saver. So something like a tomato or a pepper have perfect flowers, and so they're self-pollinating. They're less likely to cross. But the first recommendation I make is that if you have a really vibrant organic garden, to just pick one of each thing. Because if you start getting that crossing, it's sort of what we talked about earlier with the hybrids, you're potentially going to end up, and actually likely going to end up, with an inedible vegetable in the end. So if you really like a certain type of tomato, just commit to that one type of tomato, or look up in a book like Seed to Seed those isolation distances so you make sure that you have enough space in between where they're not going to cross-pollinate. But for a tomato, there's two ways to save the seeds. One, we learned from some friends down in Homer, and you can literally just take the seeds and push them, kind of rub off the gelatinous outer coating onto a paper towel, let it dry there, stick it in a Ziploc bag in the freezer, and then just rip off the squares of paper towel and plant those the next year. The way I do it is a fermentation process, and those will be, the seeds will just be put in a mason jar of water, you can cover it in a cheesecloth, and then allow it to ferment for about a week. The seeds will drop, the gelatinous coating will be removed, and then you can just dry those out and use them. You always want to let your seeds air dry.
Okay, great.
Well, we're down to the last 10 seconds. So I just wanted to thank you guys. Thank you very much, Leah and Nick, for being on the show. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and we were featuring Leah and Nick of FoundRoot.com talking about seed saving and food security, and it's been a great conversation. So please join us next week. Thanks for being here, Nick and Leah. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Have a good night.
Have
everybody.
A great night, thank everyone.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska.
Like us on Facebook, A Bridge to Everywhere, to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.